Hey, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Big Ticket Variety and iHeart's Movie Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Today, I've got Margot Robbie. The Aussie actress is getting tons of Oscar buzz for her work in Bombshell, director Jay Roach's real-life drama about the demise of Fox News boss Roger Ailes after he was accused of sexual harassment and misconduct. Margot stopped by Variety to talk about her role as an ultra-conservative producer and aspiring newscaster at Fox News. She also teases what's to come in the Suicide Squad sequel and our Harley Quinn movies, Birds of Prey. I'll have that and a whole lot more from Margot Robbie after the break. Stick around. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Now here's Margot Robbie.
How are you?
I'm good.
Congratulations. Bombshell. What did you think when you first got this script?
Well, obviously, I had the great privilege of reading a script by Charles Randolph before, so I knew it was going to be a good read. I was pretty rattled by the time I got to the end of the script, to be honest, and I knew long before I finished the script that I wanted to do it and be a part of it, just because I thought it was important to tell and be a part of and support in any way that I can. I hadn't for once thought of the character first. I thought of kind of the content and the messaging before kind of aligning myself with the character. That came next, was starting to understand Kayla.
And obviously Charlize has Megan to look at. Nicole has Gretchen. Your character is a compilation of a bunch of different. How do you find that within this world where everything else is real? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's. I think it was a good choice to do it that way. And I've played real life characters before, and I've played a lot of fictional characters before. And I couldn't say I enjoy one more than the other, or find one more difficult or more easy than the other.
But this is sort of a blend.
It's just a different sort of experience. Yeah, and this is a bit of a blend. So, I think usually when you play a real life character, there's a huge sense of responsibility that you feel to kind of do them justice and their story justice. And then you also maybe at some times feel like you can't create a character or do something. And right. That can be the line you kind of walk when you play a real life character. So to play a fictional character, which I do find extremely liberating, but I still in this case felt a big sense of responsibility knowing that she represented a lot of stories. Right. So it was a little daunting for sure, but to be honest, every character I've ever played I've found daunting, otherwise I probably wouldn't ever dive in and do it. Yeah, and it took me a minute to kind of understand her core values and where she was coming from. It wasn't so much understanding the experience she went through that took me a minute. That, you know, there was a huge amount of research already done by the filmmakers there, and honestly just being a woman and talking to other women throughout my whole life, that wasn't such a foreign sort of idea. But understanding her upbringing and her point of view on politics and the world, that really took me a minute.
So how did you come to understand it, appreciate it?
Yeah, I did. I actually started a you can find a lot online, obviously. A lot of research I find online. But Twitter was extremely helpful. I would follow these young conservative girls who were very vocal with their beliefs and their political points of view. And that was fascinating because, you know, they're my age. You know, we have, in some ways, we'd have a lot of in common. And then in other ways, I was like, we are living on totally different planets. And so that was interesting just to get a handle on the idea of, you know, her belief system and her kind of political point of view. That was a great tool, Twitter. And
what did you think after when you, because I've done that where for some reason I'll just go down a very conservative rabbit hole.
Yeah.
On Twitter. And like you said, like I'm like, am I crazy? Like, I don't, and they probably would look at, you know, liberal Twitter and be like, they're living on another planet. But it's literally, like you say, like it's literally two completely different realities.
Totally, totally. But I think what became apparent to me was, like you said, some liberal voices seemed absolutely outlandish to me as well. And what became apparent to me is that we've all been pushed so far to one end of the spectrum or the other. And it was actually really helpful to listen to a lot of talks and panels by Republicans who everything they were saying made total sense to me. And that was my way in. I was like, no, I can latch onto this conversation because it's not geared at being a clickable, salacious headline. They're not saying something that they can put on their Twitter.
So
that
outrageous.
Can be. Yeah. And I feel like really the culture has kind of perpetuated these extreme ideas because if it can't be, if it's not, you know, so if it's not so extreme, it's not going to be retweeted. And so I feel like people are kind of, you know, pushing everything to one end or the other. And I think there was a time where it wasn't so polarizing. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing was interesting, but also a great source of research was Charles himself, the writer, grew up in a very conservative family. You know, a lot of the stuff that Kayla says, Fox News, Fox is how we do church, and my family had the Fox logo burnt into the TV. That's Charles's childhood. He's like, we went through three TVs because it had the Fox logo burnt into the corner of it. So there was a lot I could kind of understand just from, and Jay too, funnily enough. There was a lot in that went into understanding Kayla, but you know, she was ambitious, she was trusting, she was hopeful. There's a lot of things I can relate to in that regard.
Do you think the motivation, I don't know if that's the right word, but what happened between Kayla and Roger Ailes in the movie, is that part of her ambition? Is that part of her trust?
I think what it's both. I think she had this innate trust in the institution of Fox News. It's something she grew up with. And I think, she had complete trust for that system and that workplace. And that put her in harm's way, ultimately, sadly, in this case. But, I think ambition obviously plays into it too. And I did like that. I think when I initially read Kayla, she was a little more naive. And it was something I had a conversation with Charles and Jay with straight off the bat. I was like, first of all, I'm not that good at playing naive. Like, I can't. And I also think she should be a little savvy. I think she should kind of know how to get ahead and want to further her career. Because if she just fell into this situation, I think it would be too easy to say, oh, well, this is terrible. What's happened? And she had no part in it. But I think what makes it more of a conflict for her is that she wanted to meet Roger Ailes. She wanted to go to his office and have a conversation about her career. She absolutely didn't want what happened to happen and had no idea that that was going to happen, but she was trying to get in that room for sure. And I think that made the situation even more difficult for her to understand afterwards. And I think it would have been confusing. I think she would have blamed herself for part of that. And that takes the recovery, you know, her recovery a lot longer to kind of deal with.
There is a scene in the movie that's, you know, quite pivotal in the storytelling between you and Kayla and Roger Ailes. It just, in this weird way, you're on the edge of your seat with it. The way the camera just holds at certain points and there's no breath.
Yeah.
And you're just holding your breath and you want to scream at the screen, like, don't, because we also, it's Monday morning quarterback and we know what's happening.
Yeah.
But then John Lithgow playing Roger Ailes.
Yeah.
I mean, his transformation.
It's unbelievable.
I mean, I keep saying what I think he played so well is that he was so pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
He was so pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
How hard is it to film a scene like that? And opposite John Lithgow looking like Roger Ailes.
It was that scene I loved. As soon as I read it in the script, I thought I was so happy that they made that choice to make the audience sit in the room with Kayla for as long as they do. I thought that was incredibly important and kind of the point of even having Kayla in this story is that, no, you're going to experience this with her and we're not going to let you off the hook and we're not going to let you get distracted by the scene that comes after this. You're going to stay in the scene for minutes with them in that room. And you're right, you kind of don't get take a breath. At the same time, the reality of shooting that scene, it's a strange scene to shoot for sure, but I couldn't hope for better people to do it with. Right. John is the loveliest human being in the world. Like, he really, really is. And we were both equally disturbed by the scene and by what, you know, is happening in the scene. And Jay was right there. He was in the room with us, and very few other crew members were. And no, I think the most potent thing about that scene is that it goes on for as long as it does.
Right.
But yeah, he totally transforms. John just you can't believe it. Especially there was another scene too where he yells at Nicole's character, Gretchen Carlson, and that was our first day of shooting. And
jeez,
I've up until that point seen lovely John, you know, was sweet, have a chat, have a cupcake and a cup of tea or whatever, and then he just comes into it and was so savage and just I was really taken aback by how much he kind of completely disappeared and became this terrifying human.
Right now we're going to take a short break, but make sure to stick around because Margot teases the Suicide Squad sequel and more of her work as Harley Quinn in Birds of Prey. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Here's more of Margot Robbie.
She's unbelievable.
Megyn Kelly has such a distinctive voice until you hear Charlize doing that voice.
Yeah, I know.
What was it like seeing her and hearing her for the first time as Megyn Kelly?
Seeing her, I didn't shock me nearly as much as the voice. The voice changed everything.
Right.
It's like she almost sat lower in her body with that voice.
Yeah.
It altered everything. And she just... Yeah, you just lose her, like John, you just lose her completely.
Because there were the shots at the beginning of the movie, they show the real Roger Ailes.
Mm.
And then there's a cut to Megyn Kelly, and literally I'm just like, is that the real Megyn Kelly?
Yeah.
Is that Charlize?
Yes. No, it's insane. They did, obviously, Kazu did incredible prosthetic work, but she changed, voice, everything, physicality, just how she would deliver every line just was so characterized. I really saw her disappear, and she did. And she was producing at the same time,
right.
You know, it's not like she didn't have one sole focus. She was, you know, being pulled in a million different directions and just handled it like a boss. She's so impressive.
So if you could sit down with Megyn Kelly, what would you ask her?
You know, I've watched quite a few interviews. I would have asked Megyn Kelly is why did you say that thing about Santa? Why did you, you know, like, there'd be a lot of questions on what was the thought process behind that one. But then I did see this interview where she was like, look, I'm on air however many 40 hours live a week. I'm going to say stuff that I later regret. And I thought, yeah, you know what, every time I do something live I'm absolutely terrified, and you kind of sometimes speak before you think. This isn't me justifying anything she said, by the way, but I did, it was an interesting thing to go, oh yeah, you know what, you really can find a way to understand everyone's scenario, which obviously Charlize has done a lot of. I think that was one of her biggest challenges, was just understanding the things her character,
well, that,
the real life person
thing.
That her character did and said, even while we were shooting,
your delivery,
Megyn Kelly,
yes,
did and said a few things that I'm sure made Charlize, you know, made it even harder for her to go into work that day.
Because you are delivering this, the movie does deliver a message. It's telling, you know, there's lessons to be had, but it's also from the perspective of women who work at Fox News.
Yeah.
And people we know have a very big issue with Fox News and whatever they were, for lack of a better term, spewing on Fox News. So
yeah.
How does the audience sort of find that empathy, but at the same time, it's like, but you're Fox News.
I know. Well, I mean, there might be a big portion of the audience who do watch Fox News and appreciate everything that's being said, but I think it really goes beyond. I feel like, as with most great stories, that acts as the framework and the backdrop, and really you're watching humans do what humans do, and that's what fascinates me, but I think that's what truly fascinates audiences is that human behavioral study that you get to do when you watch people react to a situation and you wonder what the hell they were thinking or not react or whatever it is. It ultimately poses much bigger questions, I think, than if we were focusing solely on politics.
Right.
Yeah.
It goes beyond politics.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
So Suicide Squad 2. Joel Kinnaman.
Good segue.
And on a lighter note.
On a lighter note.
Joel Kinnaman was sitting in the seat that you're sitting in right now.
Was he?
Yes, 2 weeks ago. And he was telling me how much fun it is. He said it's a really funny script.
Yeah, it is.
And that's a big difference from Suicide Squad 1. What could you tell me?
He's right. It's a really, I mean, I think people, wouldn't be surprised when hearing that James Gunn wrote it and is directing it. You're going to be laughing a lot. But it's going to be good is all I can say for now. It's going to be very, very good, I think.
And you all went to go see The Joker together.
We did.
What did you think?
I was absolutely blown away by Joaquin, obviously. I already considered him to be one of the greatest actors of our generation. Mm-hmm. So that didn't, I was kind of prepared to see some acting muscles getting flexed there and be like impressed by it. I knew that was coming. I also thought Todd made a beautiful film. It was confronting.
Yeah.
For sure.
Would you want to see his Joker in the Suicide Squad?
I think they exist in different universes. Yeah. You know, I think the Joker film that's just come out exists in a very different universe than the Suicide Squad film or Birds of Prey or even the first Suicide Squad film or even Nolan's, version of Gotham. And I think that's kind of a cool thing that DC does. Everyone has their interpretation of Gotham. And at first, maybe I thought it was like a little incongruous to jump in and out of different versions, but now I really appreciate it because I like seeing every filmmaker's different interpretation of the characters and of the world.
Right.
So no, I don't think Joaquin's Joker would make sense in that universe of James Gunn's version of the
Birds
world.
Birds of Prey, Suicide Squad, how is Harley different?
She's from the first Suicide Squad.
Or just how did you approach Harley in a different way for Birds of Prey?
No, she's still the same character, but she's evolved. Mm-hmm. She obviously has a lot more screen time in Birds of Prey than she did in the first Suicide Squad film. So you're going to spend more time with her. But also the story in Birds of Prey is told from her point of view. Mm-hmm. So you have an insight into Harley's world in a way that you didn't in the first Suicide Squad film, nor that you'll have in the next Suicide Squad film. So it's a little bonkers. I mean, it reflects her personality. It's heightened. It's poppy. It's fun. It's violent. It's crazy. It's absurd. It's kooky. It's hilarious. It's a little heartbreaking. You know, it's, I think all the elements that make Harley who she is, you feel in different ways of the filmmaking approach in Birds of Prey.
How but long do you want to play Harley for?
Forever. as long as the fans will allow me to, really. It's in my mind, it's kind of up to them. I know I have so much more to give as Harley. She's such a good character, and there's so much of her that we still haven't even explored. Even after doing Birds of Prey, there's still so much to be explored there. So I'd love to keep exploring that. But ultimately, the day the fans say, no, we're done with you, Margot, I'll happily step aside.
And then Barbie, what's going on? When's it going to happen?
It's very early stages of development right now, so not so much to report on that one, but very excited at the prospect.
How do you bring a doll to life?
You'll have to wait and see. Don't know. Honestly, I don't know yet. we'll figure it out.
Did you play with Barbies when you were a kid?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like everyone kind of has that. They have some sort of, that's what excited me about the project. Everyone has a Barbie memory. Even if someone's childhood memory was stealing their sister's Barbie and chopping all her hair off and burying her in the backyard.
Is that what you did?
That wasn't what I did, but I know there's some brothers out there who definitely, but I feel like she was present for everyone's childhood in one way or another, which makes it such an interesting and fun sort of thing too.
And Greta and Noah.
Clever people. Gosh, they're busy right now. Little Women and Marriage Stories.
Right, I was like, people we call Little Barbie? Little Barbie Story?
I'll pitch that to you.
Awesome, Margaret. Thank you so much.
That's it for this episode of The Big Ticket, but come back tomorrow because I've got another episode. I sat down with Sterling K. Brown to talk Waves, This Is Us, Frozen 2, and a whole lot more. Thanks for listening to The Big Ticket. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Mark Malkin. See you tomorrow.